I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. I'm the Vice Chairman of Internal Medicine at Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas, Texas. And it's my pleasure in October of 2020 to provide a critical update to you on SARS-CoV-2 worldwide pandemic and the COVID-19 illness. Now, the opinions I will present are the opinions of my own, as well as my co-authors and collaborators, and don't represent the opinions of my institutions. Currently, at the time of this recording, we are at 38 million cases of COVID-19, 1.1 million deaths in the world. In the United States, 8 million cases, 220,000 deaths. The United States, disappointingly, it ranks as one of the highest in the world in terms of deaths per million population. Now, we've learned a lot progressing from the very first cases in February, March, April, and May. And starting in June, I put together a collaboration between the United States and Italy, countries that were being hit hard by COVID-19, to come up with recommendations for practitioners for the early outpatient treatment of COVID-19, with the idea that outpatient treatment is the only hope in reducing the risk of hospitalization and death. You've heard a lot about advances in in-hospital care, and there's no doubt about it. Patients who do present to hospital in general have had no outpatient treatment, present after 2 weeks of illness, very severely ill. They're put into isolation, and they do receive supportive care, and there have been some advancements. There's still a minority of patients who receive the antiviral remdesivir. There's a minority of patients who receive convalescent plasma. But of course, all patients receive supportive care, and hopefully they'll survive. Sadly, we know many patients succumb to death in the hospital. In fact, the vast majority of COVID-19 deaths occur in the hospital. So we felt in this international collaboration that it was pivotal that we devise an emergency program for the outpatient treatment of COVID-19 with currently available over-the-counter and prescription pharmaceuticals that had a proven safety track record. And we looked at this very carefully. We had specialists in internal medicine, critical care, nephrology, cardiology, electrophysiology, again with an eye towards safety of various agents, infectious diseases, of course, ophthalmology, again with respect to safety, epidemiology, and biostatistics. This was a U.S.-Italian multi-center collaboration. We had academic medical centers, community medical centers, schools of public health, as well as a leader from the biotech industry. The title of our paper was The Pathophysiologic Basis and Rationale for Early Outpatient Treatment of SARS-CoV-2 COVID-19 Infection. This was published in the American Journal of Medicine in August 7th of 2020. And this, what I'm going to present to you, is the first published peer-reviewed treatment guidance for practitioners who are caring for ambulatory patients with COVID-19. In a sense, you can think about yourselves as the second front line. We've heard a lot about the front line of hospital physicians, intensive care unit workers, nurses, and their efforts have been heroic, but we haven't heard much regarding the second front line. That is, all the ambulatory-based doctors and advanced practitioners who receive calls on a daily basis or have patients present to their office acutely ill. We haven't heard from them much at all, and we felt this paper was a critical update and filled a very important void in terms of guidance and understanding of what would be reasonable on an emergency basis right here, right now, to take care of patients with COVID-19. At the time we put this paper together, much had been learned about the illness. There had been over 50,000 peer-reviewed publications in the National Library of Medicine. And as shown on this slide, it was clear that there's a very early viral infection and replication phase. This takes several days and is associated with some of the cardinal early symptoms, including fever, sore throat, malaise, body aches, nasal stuffiness, loss of taste, anorexia, nausea, and diarrhea. Some of you listening have had the syndrome, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. We understand that the testing for the presence of the virus based on the nasal PCR assay, as well as oral PCR and oral antigen assays, is very helpful when it's positive. So when a patient has a characteristic syndrome and their test is positive. In fact, they have it. The problem is that when patients have the characteristic signs and symptoms of COVID-19 and the test is negative, what we know there is it's most likely to be a false negative, and we should go ahead and treat as if they have COVID-19. Now, approximately 3 or more days into the illness, and clearly by day 7, there is immune dysregulation and what's called cytokine storm. Those of you who have cared for patients will recognize early on there's a depressed lymphocyte count. There's a high C-reactive protein. There's cough and difficulty breathing, a characteristic pattern on chest X-ray and chest CT, which is called the COVID-19 pattern, probably reflects some viral pneumonia, but as well as cytokine damage to the lungs. Between 7 and 14 days, the real surprise with this virus is the development of microthrombosis. This has been shown in autopsy studies done in Europe in patients who have succumbed to COVID-19. Microthrombi are found in the lungs and contributing to desaturation and dyspnea, chest heaviness. There have been dramatic cases of systemic thromboembolism, both on the arterial and venous side. Associated with this are very high D-dimer levels, and it's now learned that patients require above normal levels of anticoagulation in the hospital when these syndromes set in. But importantly, at the top of the slide has been what has been learned from in-hospital care. The first is the use of off-target antivirals. Initially, oral antivirals were used, and this progressed to the FDA-approved remdesivir, which is an intravenous product that has an effect on reducing viral replication by inhibiting the RNA-dependent polymerase once the virus is inside cells and attempting to replicate. Very importantly has been the understanding that corticosteroids play a role. Corticosteroids at the onset of the cytokine storm, not at the very beginning of the infection, but probably 3 or more days into the infection, corticosteroids have a dramatic effect on improving symptoms and have a proven role in reducing mortality. And then lastly, the use of antiplatelet drugs and antithrombotics. And it's probably wise at this point in time to understand that antiplatelet drugs may play a role all the way through at typically higher doses that we normally use because of activation of thromboxane A2. But the big surprise is the need for the use of standard antithrombotics, drugs that block the coagulation cascade that we normally use for arterial and venous pathologic thrombosis, now using this in the setting of the viral infection. So what I'm going to share with you now is the first peer-reviewed, published algorithm for an outpatient physician or advanced practitioner to manage COVID-19 in the outpatient realm in the United States or really anywhere in the world. This is the first and only published set of recommendations that exist at this point in time. And it came from a real critical need to provide an emergency approach right here, right now, with available drugs, given the burden of hospitalizations and mortality, and the fact that the hospital can't save patients who are in the terminal phase of COVID-19. Here's the algorithm, and I'll walk you through it. If a patient presents with COVID-19-like or COVID-19-confirmed illness by testing, patients are instructed to go into self-quarantine at home, control contagion, try to reduce contamination and infection of others. Age under 50, no medical problems. The vast majority of individuals simply need to serve out their quarantine. Once they become asymptomatic for several days, they can return to usual work and interaction. Watchful waiting is advised. However, if symptoms worsen or if individuals have a comorbidity, are young or over age 50, with a single comorbidity such as obesity, heart or lung disease, heart disease, kidney disease, prior or existing cancer, they really should start treatment. And treatment is in the yellow, blue, green, blue again, and fuchsia boxes as they flow through the diagram. So the first line of treatment is the use of high-dose zinc, over-the-counter zinc sulfate, 220 milligrams a day. It's believed in other coronavirus infections, that this can play an early role in reducing viral replication. And then employing two or more off-target antiviral agents. And what I mean by that is these drugs weren't originally designed as antiviral drugs for COVID-19. However, in preclinical and clinical studies, they've shown to have efficacy. Now, none of these agents is a magic bullet. And I should say parenthetically that it's known that we treat viral infections, serious viral infections, always with multiple drugs. That's true for acute HIV infection. That's true for hepatitis C. That even with a reactivation zoster shingles, we use the combination of steroids and an antiviral. So it shouldn't be unfamiliar to you as a seasoned clinician to understand that we do need to use multi-drug programs in the treatment of outpatient COVID-19. Not a single drug can carry the day. Now, hydroxychloroquine, as shown on the left-hand side of this slide, is the most proven of the approaches. In preclinical studies, hydroxychloroquine, when utilized, is very effective. It reduces endosomal entry and transfer of the virus particle. It reduces viral replication by 99%. And in clinical studies, retrospective studies and clinical trials, when employed early, 100% of those studies have demonstrated a positive result. Now, 78% overall of the hydroxychloroquine studies have met peer review. Importantly, there's been 5 randomized trials of hydroxychloroquine in early ambulatory patients, and in a meta-analysis of 5 administratively halted trials, which each one of them were inconclusive, when the data are combined, hydroxychloroquine, most commonly with an antibiotic, is associated with a 24% reduction in COVID-19 infection, hospitalization, and death, and this is a highly statistically significant result. Hydroxychloroquine is safe. My personal view is that if a patient does not have a history of prolonged QT syndrome congenitally, or if they are not on significant QT prolonging drugs, such as Sotalol, that hydroxychloroquine is very safe to use. It does not have other cardiac toxicities. Our authors were very careful on the safety review of hydroxychloroquine, including a senior electrophysiologist. So I'm confident that hydroxychloroquine is safe and effective. It's been used in millions of individuals across the globe over 65 years, that it can be used as a base in the treatment for COVID-19 in the early ambulatory phase. It's administered 200 milligrams twice a day, most commonly with azithromycin, 250 milligrams twice a day, or doxycycline, 100 milligrams twice a day. Why? Because these antibiotics also have a mild antiviral effect. They cover atypical pneumonias very well as bacterial superinfection. Now, moving over to the middle part of the antiviral box, is the second off-target antiviral, and that's ivermectin. Ivermectin is an antiparasitic agent that also has proven antiviral effects. It works by inhibiting the viral entry into the nucleus of cells, so it works from a different perspective than hydroxychloroquine. And this drug has no cardiac toxicity that has been reported. It also is combined with the 2 antibiotics that I reviewed. However, dosing is not so well worked out. The dosing is 200 micrograms per kilogram. It comes out to roughly 12 milligrams a day, and it has a half-life of about 25 hours. So it's unclear if it should be given once a day or given for 2 doses or 3 doses. One protocol has actually given it for 3 doses and shown efficacy. There have been 5 prospective studies and 1 randomized trial with ivermectin, and it's certainly a choice when available to treat COVID-19 at home, and it's very safe and available. The third choice is favipiravir, not available in the United States, but approved and used to treat COVID-19 in 30 countries that have been far more successful than the United States. And these include Japan, Russia, India. Favipiravir is an oral RNA-dependent polymerase inhibitor. So in a sense, it works like intravenous remdesivir. And it is administered typically with an antibiotic at the onset of infection. It has Again, preclinical data and supportive clinical nasal PCR clearance data. However, there are no large outcomes published on favipiravir that I'm aware of. The dosing scheme, as I put here, is 600 milligrams twice a day, although most practitioners give a higher first-day loading dose at 1,200, 1,600, or 1,800 milligrams twice a day, depending on tablet sizes in your country. Importantly, if respiratory symptoms are already present or patients get to 5 days of illness and still feel unwell, the recommendation is corticosteroids. My personal view is the best corticosteroid to use prednisone, 1 milligram per kilogram, which is typically 60 or 80 milligrams of prednisone per day for 5 days, with or without a taper. Now, if the patients have some pleuritic chest pain or evidence of pleuritis, colchicine, a common drug used for pericarditis and gout, 0.6 milligrams can be used twice a day. Now, corticosteroids are very important in combating cytokine storm, and also it should be pointed out that there is proof of concept in randomized trials. So the RECOVERY trial was a late-stage trial where patients who were severely ill, many on the ventilator, were administered dexamethasone 6 milligrams a day versus usual care. And what was shown is that there was a statistically significant reduction in mortality. However, the dexamethasone group still had an unacceptably high overall mortality at 22.9%. So this didn't prove that dexamethasone is the steroid of choice, but showed proof of concept for corticosteroids. My personal view is that prednisone, which is a much more balanced steroid, it has a longer mechanism of action, is uniformly available, and we're comfortable using it in asthma, allergic pneumonitis, and other conditions, that prednisone ought to be the featured steroid. I have experience in using both, and I can tell you I've had patients languish on dexamethasone and promptly respond on prednisone. Finally is the issue of addressing microthrombosis. Patients may have serious underlying medical conditions and be at risk for venous thrombosis anyway. And we may suspect microaortic thrombosis with chest heaviness, desaturation, progressive dyspnea. Hopefully, patients have been on aspirin all the way through. My suggestion is aspirin 325 milligrams because we know thromboxane A2 is excessively activated in the setting of this infection. 81 milligrams a day may not be enough. But importantly, when there is suspected microthrombosis or if patients have two or more medical comorbidities, we should actually use an antithrombotic. Low molecular weight heparin, so that would be a prescription. Lovenox at 40 milligrams twice a day would be a sample program. The use of apixaban, rivaroxaban, dabigatran, edoxaban in the standard doses that we use for venous thromboembolism or atrial fibrillation are advised. Now, this may seem aggressive, but COVID-19 hospitalization and death are serious outcomes. Both of them are serious outcomes. And as shown on the right-hand side of the screen, patients over age 50 who have one or more comorbidities, in my view, they should get the entire program in a sequenced multi-drug approach that's well coordinated by the physician, by telemedicine phone, or by office visit if need be. Hopefully, patients stay on room air as shown on the right-hand side of the slide. If we can have pulse oximetry to the home, terrific. Many patients may already have home oxygen because they have lung disease or heart disease, and we need to carefully monitor their oxygen levels. Keep in mind, if you get deep into the syndrome, 10 days or more, and patients feel poorly, have respiratory symptoms, they can suddenly desaturate, and the family and caregivers need to know that we have to be wise on pulling the trigger for when patients do need to go to the hospital. I personally think patients who go to the hospital really should need high flow oxygen or assisted ventilation. Otherwise, this whole syndrome can be managed at home. Everything on this slide is done anyway in the hospital. What we're proposing is to advance hospital care into the home and begin to reduce the millions of hospitalizations that are occurring in the United States due to COVID-19. And by the method of reducing the hospitalizations, we have a great opportunity in reducing mortality for COVID-19. In my view, it's the only way to do it. Now, many of you have been involved in treating patients with COVID-19, so the information presented is supportive. I recognize that prior to this, there was no standardized approach, and practitioners have tried all types of things to help their patients, as they should in the setting of an emergency pandemic. No physician should sit by idle and not care for patients and not respond to patients who have a potentially fatal viral illness. We all took the Hippocratic Oath. We have the fiduciary responsibility to the patient, us, doctors and care providers, all of you who have the medical knowledge and the ability to prescribe medications that are available at local pharmacies. I'm talking to you. We can't wait for the NIH, the CDC, the US FDA, or guidelines committees to tell us what to do for COVID-19. Those bodies rely on randomized trials that will take 2 to 4 years to complete. Those bodies, many of them, actually have no track record in advising doctors what to do for the care of patients. It's up to us to do this now with the full recognition that randomized trials will come in and randomized trials will modify our approach as suggested here. For instance, there's a very high quality, large scale randomized trial of colchicine. Colchicine may become a real standard in that middle box for cytokine storm. There's also a very high quality trial underway regarding thrombosis, and that's with rivaroxaban. These are high quality outpatient trials. When these trials report and come in, we will adapt. And I anticipate that this algorithm, which has already been adapted 2 months after its original publication in American Journal of Medicine, it's currently in press for an October update, which is what you're seeing right here, that this will be modified many times in the future. But the time is to act is now. And I don't want to see another patient in the United States present after 2 weeks of languishing at home with no home treatment, only to become isolated, never seeing their family members again, and then in the most unfortunate cases, succumbing to death due to COVID-19. Let's all step up now as the second front line in COVID-19 and do our job in the pandemic and emergency of our lifetime. If I can help anybody in any way, please feel free to reach out to me, and thank you for your attention.